Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I am joined today by my guest, Jessica Lipsky. Jessica is a journalist and DJ from Brooklyn, New York. Her writing on the intersection of culture, music, and politics has appeared in the New York Times, NPR, Billboard, Vice, Newsweek, and many other publications. Jessica's latest book is It Ain't Retro, Daptone Records and the 21st Century Soul Revolution, and is published by Jawbone Press. Jessica, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Please share with us what your book is about.
Sure. My book is a biography of Daptone Records, which I argue is one of the most important recording houses in a generation. And they are the progenitors, maybe not quite progenitors, but the leaders of a soul revival. That is, people who are putting out 60s and 70s style funk and soul music. That's through the likes of Sharon Jones and Dap Kings, Charles Bradley, and many others. And It Ain't Retro is a biography of the label as well as the larger funk and soul scene that they help lead and that's sprouted around them.
How would you describe the Daptone Records sound?
I would say that Daptone Records has had an evolution in sound. They started off as shitty but pretty in their early days and have become this perfectly imperfect sound that adores the production of the 60s and 70s, where everything was analog, was focused on drums, vocals, and really, really killer horns.
You begin your book by introducing us to the Daptone Records label through the Daptone Super Soul Review at the Apollo Theater, which was a very significant event that kind of cemented, I think at that time, their legacy already. And if anyone out there has not seen video footage of the performances at the Apollo Theater, it's amazing. Share with us what the review was and what was the cultural significance of it.
Absolutely. So the Daptone Super Soul Review happened over a couple of nights in 2014 at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, which, if anyone knows anything about soul music, is a very important place. And at this point, Daptone had been around for well over a decade, and before that was putting out similar music as Desco Records. This was a chance to do a review of all of their music, all of their musicians on an amazing hometown stage, and also a showcase for Sharon Jones, who at that point had survived a bout of cancer and had come back roaring. So to be able to play on the same stage as James Brown, one of their major, major influences, was huge for them. And totally sold out. I was living in California at the time, which is where I'm from, and I remember thinking, man, I should get a ticket out to see this, right? I should go, right? And I never did, and I deeply regret that.
But you've seen other performances from Daptone artists.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there was a great documentary about the Apollo show called Living on Soul, The Family Daptone. I would also have no doubt that at some point Daptone will put out its own documentary or like series of videos from that. They shot a lot of footage.
I really hope so. So Daptone Records was founded by Bosco Mann, whose government name is Gabriel Roth. That's what you say in your book. And I thought that was so funny. But before Daptone Records, you mentioned there was Desco Records, and Bosco had founded that with his partner, Philippe Lehmann. Who are Bosco and Philippe, and what were their backgrounds?
Both of these guys are record heads. Bosco, aka Gabe Roth, is a Jewish guy from Riverside, California, who made his way to New York for school and had always had this fascination with record collecting and with soul music. He was going to college playing in bands and encountered Phil Lehmann out in the world of record nerds. The two of them had this shared passion for really dirty, gritty, fucked up funk records. And they decided that they needed to start something around that, because at the time that style of music wasn't really popular in New York, where they were based, or elsewhere, really.
And I wouldn't just add just popular, but there's an accessibility element as well. You know, in our correspondence before this interview, I discovered Daptone Records via Sharon Jones in 2007 with her album 100 Days, 100 Nights. I fortunately was going to a town, I was going to college in a town that had a small independent record shop that had that, but nowhere else that I, you know, imagine that anywhere else in Kentucky or in some of the surrounding states in the Midwest would have that kind of stuff. So even before that, you know, at the end of the 90s, when Gabe and Philippe are doing their Desco thing, would I ever imagine I could have access to that kind of stuff? So that's incredible that there were those scenes for that. You say in your book that Desco Records was a musical innovation that sounded like a blast from the past, but was created in the shadow of a new millennium. Where was soul music before Desco's founding?
Good question. Soul music was sort of relegated to the world of oldies, right? You could hear a lot of the sounds of the 60s and 70s on oldies radio, as I definitely did growing up. But it was sort of has-been. R&B and hip-hop were taking flight. And you had really innovative musicians who were picking from that same well, but it wasn't really in popular consciousness. Like James Brown, you know, was coming off like a few really bad years of addiction and doing commercials, and all of these other performers from the 60s were, you know, playing gigs at small bars every so often. But they weren't necessarily revered by the public in the same way. From what I understand, it was sort of an afterthought. Like, these guys are has-beens, and we are standing on their shoulders, but, you know, we're not actively engaging with their catalogs.
And that's kind of amazing that you explore that, because you discuss a lot of these scenes in the early days of Daptone, or even during Desco and before, where soul was kind of, it was utilized, you know. For example, the New York music scene was largely dominated by hip hop and indie rock, but there was a small subculture. A lot of it involved sampling. Can you talk about that and what was happening in the soul underground during that time?
Absolutely. So as you said, the New York scene was largely hip hop related or focused, and you have people who were really working their way through that scene that today are major players in funk and soul, like Mark Ronson, like Questlove, Pharrell, for example, as well. And within the underground, there are people who are collectors and DJs, and this happens from the mid-80s with the Empire State Soul Club through to the late 90s when you have people like Chairman Mao and DJs Frankie and Glacey, who are performing these sort of like deep cuts to dancers and working them in a way that today would make sense for like the average listener. He'd say, yes, I know that hip hop came from these samples. And even then people would know, but wouldn't necessarily hear them together at the average club.
And Bosco and Philippe, they were around the scenes at this time, exploring this music. What were they taking from that kind of experience, from the subculture, and how did they want to grow that? What was the I guess, philosophy of their vision for this music?
Well, Lehman, I'm not so sure what his philosophy was. He seems to be this sort of like avant-garde wealthy guy who is just like interested in doing what was not popular, what was just interesting to him. Gabe, I think, was in and around these cultures and just took the raw joy that people felt, that people, you know, visually put off at clubs when they heard this music. And to him, I think it was a bit, it was a bit affirming of his own taste, though, as you might get from reading this book, I don't think Gabe really needs anybody to affirm his taste because he knows it's good. And this was, you know, brought further into the foray as he did the show across 110th Street on WKCR, which is still on today.
So further exploring New York City and the soul subculture, you write that the city's politics were causing a social shift around this time with then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani's focus on crime control and urban renewal. How did that have an impact on the subculture of soul music, and how were people responding to that?
I don't think that it had too much of a direct impact on soul music, with the exception of the fact that it became a bit harder to find records literally on the street because people have recounted just walking anywhere and people were bending constantly. I think the greater effect that it had was people sort of shifted out of Manhattan, which for many, many years was the cultural center of New York City. It pushed them to Brooklyn, where people could do whatever they wanted, where there were warehouse parties, where there was more space for bands to practice. I think that the 90s also probably helped more artists come into the city and imbue it with that additional sense of creativity from outside places. Anybody who lives in New York knows that it's kind of rare to find a native New Yorker. So those additional voices and perspectives and talents from other places are helpful, which is not to say that Daptone isn't made up of native New Yorkers too.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those other places. You discussed that around the same time soul was growing in New York, soul had already been a major fixture in Los Angeles for at least two generations. So tell us about the scene from where you're from, and how did Daptone sound fit in with that?
Sure. So I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I grew up listening to a lot of oldies from the station that was formerly known as KSAN or KFRC, and KFRC, excuse me, and also a oldies program on 98.1 KISS FM called the Sunday Super Oldies. So that was a big part of my education growing up, and where I found out about a lot of Motown and Stax Records and other smaller labels. And that exists in the Bay Area, but in Los Angeles, that same tradition, I think, is multiplied. Lots of generations, particularly Latinos, Chicanos, other people who just like oldies, grew up listening to these records, calling into programs by run by Art LeBeau, and passing these like love songs down generation by generation. And it didn't really matter that it wasn't popular on the radio. It didn't matter if maybe you had a different lifestyle than your parents. There are these like connecting things that are songs, through families and ways that you tell stories. So I think that that love of old 60s music really primed people in Southern California for Daptone sounds.
So it's interesting when we talk about how this music kind of found an audience through DJs and clubs and the subculture, and all this is pre-internet, and it's having an effect on how people kind of perceive the music. And one story you tell in your book about the early days of these labels is how Gabe Bosco was fooled by a band called the Poets of Rhythm, thinking they were black when they were actually a group of white Germans, and even going as far as referring to them as German James Browns. How did experiences like that and those kind of sounds impact their connection with soul and their thinking of soul, and just how widespread and accessible it could be to a lot of different people?
Well, I think if you come from any sort of subculture, before you find your tribe, you're really like, am I the only person in the world that likes this music? Am I just really weird? Who can I find? How can I share this? And I think for Bosco and for others, hearing people like, hearing bands like Poets of Rhythm really blew their mind. It proved to them there were other people out there that were into the same things. So the Poets of Rhythm proved they were a test case that modern people could make music in a 60s and 70s style. And being able to see that, to hear that, I don't think I actually saw them live, was crucial. And it would follow that later Daptone would put out records by the Poets of Rhythm.
So why did Desco Records dissolve?
Creative differences, probably financial differences that other people don't feel like disclosing. But it sort of went as far as they could go, I think. Phil wanted to do one thing, Gabe wanted to do another. And at this sort of really poetic time, the dawn of the new millennium, they decide to part ways after having this great trip to Barcelona, where the Dap Kings really formed. So I think that Phil Lehman wanted to have less of a hands-on approach with his records, and Bosco Mann, who is a very particular individual, wanted to have a lot of creative influence on his. There were also a series of deals gone wrong that had nothing to do with the partners that I think influenced Gabe's desire to do his own thing.
Deals going wrong in the music industry is a story as old as time.
So Daptone came into being at a sort of auspicious time in the music industry, where there were so many changes happening with the dissolution of labels, with the advent of streaming, with CDs and MP3s, and all of these changes happening. So the fact that the label was able to really make it through as an independent organization really just speaks to their determination, their love of the music, and the caliber of musicianship.
So after Desco dissolved, Gabe founded Daptone Records in 2001 with a person named Neil Sugarman. Who was Neil, and what was his journey toward founding Daptone with Gabe?
So Neil was the leader of the Sugarman 3, which is one of the Desco groups that recorded a lot at the 41st Street studio. And he and Gabe had developed a good relationship. He was doing a lot of the management of his band. And when Desco ended and Gabe had these offers to do different records but wasn't really into anything, Neil was having the same issues. And they developed this sort of, well, if you make them, I'll sling them partnership, where Neil did a lot of the marketing work from his various apartments in Brooklyn, and Gabe would be the sort of creative glue. And over the years, they continued in that path of, you know, business and creativity, with Neil playing in the Sugarman 3 and also in Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
So we were talking earlier about a lot of the changes that were happening in the music industry, primarily because of technology. You had the internet, which brought in the advent of streaming in the form of piracy. Downloading Napster was a big thing. And I know that a lot of artists and the industry were trying to wrestle with what this meant for the industry in terms of monetization of music on the internet. I know David Bowie famously tried to release an album in 2001 on the internet, didn't quite work out, came out two decades later. But what's fascinating about Daptone is that very early on, it was just all vinyl. And I want to get a sense of what their business decisions were like at that time when the industry is so changing by really committing to this revivalist mentality, not just with the sound, but of a business model as well.
And it's really interesting too, because even though they were so insistent on vinyl, that didn't really work for them initially. I tell a few stories in my book of how they would go out with these brand new Lee Fields records, the first things he had recorded in decades, but no record store wanted them because they were new, because everybody had this idea that modern funk was terrible. And even people who were in funk wouldn't listen to modern funk. So they would have to go back, scratch up these records, make them look old, and then can finally sell them. So even though they knew they were making records for other collectors and fans, there was still a bit of a schism in how that would actually make money. And it took them years to turn a profit, for sure. I think that their insistence on this vinyl production, vinyl distribution, and although they, of course, do have things on the internet and various streaming services, their insistence on that really was just them holding on to their core values and showing people, well, you know, we have this physical medium that you can buy at our shows, and we are touring so hard, and people would want to play that that medium. Of course, their insistence on using vinyl as the primary means of musical distribution, or audio distribution rather, was really way ahead of the game. And we've seen vinyl surge in sales in the past few years.
Absolutely. And that's not to say that the team at Daptone were Luddites of, because they weren't, even though they were committing to very early on this vinyl. They had the Daptone Super Superstore. I can never remember this. The Daptone Records Superstore, Super Soul Superstore. Here we go. And so they were had that you know, really early on. And I remember when I first heard about Daptone Records, and I was producing and hosting a soul music show in college, I was connecting with their PR people on MySpace. So they were active, you know, very early on in the Wild West days of social media. So it was interesting to kind of just experience that convergence of this label so committed to a retro style and format, but try to traverse the landscape of the internet when so many people with a lot more money and a lot more ideas and a lot more resources are trying to do the exact same thing as well.
That's a really good point. And I mean, there are very committed people behind the scenes who are doing social media, who are doing their marketing, but they definitely don't have an apparatus behind them. To pivot just a bit, this dedication isn't just specific to Daptone. For example, Coal Mine Records, who came about a decade after, their founder, Terry Cole, is so big into indie retail, he would literally drive to record stores in his beat-up car and, you know, meet with people in person, and his entire business is based on indie retail. So I think that this shows that like begets like, and if you're really searching for something, now that we have the tools easily accessible, you will find what you're looking for. Or
absolutely.
Maybe... I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, I mean, or maybe as with you and with me, we share this this background. You'll happen across a CD or a record at your college radio station.
Absolutely, it's incredible what they were able to do. And they had such really rough days. I know early on they bought that townhouse in Bushwick, Brooklyn, that was practically torn apart, and they even had some of the stars on their label, like Charles Bradley and Sharon Jones, kind of gut rehab and put it together. A lot of lean years, those early years. So share with us what those early days at Daptone was like and some of the challenges they faced.
Sure. Well, first, they didn't own this building. They just rented it from a slumlord in the grand tradition of New York tenancy. So they moved into this neighborhood that now has been gentrified, but at the time definitely wasn't. And they get into this busted old house, and somebody somewhere has a brilliant vision for it. So they start breaking down walls, finding tires from various places, and isolating the vocal room, stuffing the top, like floating it on top of the tires, stuffing those tires with rags. Gabe buys a bunch of fabric at a discount from an old theater store and sends it to his mother in California so she can sew him sound dampening curtains for the live room. The storage on the second floor of the House of Soul also doubles as a kitchen. And they tried to remove walls. They realized that those were load-bearing, and they had to jack them up again using like a car jack. All of the guys from the Budos band, who, if anyone knows anything about the Budos band, are super metal and probably really into any kind of destruction, especially if it is constructive destruction. They, you know, knocked down walls, then hauled all of these bags of trash to a friendly dump in Staten Island. And, you know, you can only imagine what sort of community and family building scene that must have been to really literally build something from the ground up.
So we've mentioned a couple of artists on the Daptone label already, and of course the one we have to discuss the most, or not even the most, but the label's big major star is Sharon Jones. She came on the scene in their community when it was Desco, performing backing vocals on Lee Field's song "Let a Man Do What He Wanna Do," and she would eventually become the first major star. But she had a rough background. Can you tell us where she came from, what her background was, and how she became involved with Daptone Records?
Absolutely. So Sharon Jones is from the same area as James Brown in North Augusta, South Carolina, and moved to Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, just a little ways from where I am now, as a child. And she grew up in the 60s at a, you know, complicated time for America, for Black people, also a very exciting time, and sang her whole life. She sang in her church choir, which is the foundation of, I think, her vocal training, and ended up becoming a choir director at a very young age. And even though she had all of this talent and a whole lot of personality and drive, Sharon never made it in the music business in a traditional sense. She did some backing vocals. She sang in a wedding band. She was on some house tracks, but she was never a full-time musician until her 40s and 50s. She worked as a prison guard at Rikers Island, which is a pretty infamous prison in New York. I later learned that she and my mother worked there at the same time, but they didn't know each other. That would have been way too cool. She worked for Macy's. She worked as an armored car guard. And all the while is still maintaining this passion for music. So in the 90s, when Gabe Roth is recording Lee Fields, he is looking for some backup singers. And one of his musicians is like, "Oh yeah, my girlfriend knows somebody." So they're supposed to bring in three women the next day for backing vocals. And Sharon Jones is the one that walks through the door and insists, "Why pay three people when you can just play me?" Why pay three people when you can just pay me? And then she proceeded to blow them out of the water. And I think that there was a little bit of skepticism, and a healthy amount of skepticism, between the parties. She was thinking, who are all these young white guys who are doing soul? And they're wondering, like, who is this woman? Why does she want to sing with us? Can she really bring enough for three people? And she definitely did. So Sharon came into the fold pretty quickly. And I think there was a deep love and admiration there. And it lasted from probably the day they met until the day she died.
She had been told long throughout her career that she wasn't made for music because she was too fat, too black, and too old. And she internalized these negative comments to push herself throughout her career. Tell us about the early years when Sharon was beginning to grow a following and what it did for the label. How Sharon was able to be the glue that held Daptone together and how their relationship evolved.
Well, to anybody that has heard a Sharon Jones record, there is just such vibrancy, such energy. You can't sit down and listen to her sing. So to see Sharon Jones is like that, but to the nth degree. And Daptone really realized that Sharon had this performing power early on. She had great stage presence. She knew how to dance. She would dress well, especially later on. And she really knew how to engage the audience. So they realized if people could see Sharon perform, they would want to buy records. They would come back. They would tell their friends. So Daptone with Sharon hit the road really hard on a lot of cross-country tours, on several European tours. And as they're performing, they're honing their skills, their camaraderie, and developing the sound of what would become Sharon Jones and the Daptones. So Sharon's skill, her passion, and like her effervescence were absolutely integral to the creation of the Daptone sound and to its success. I think without Sharon, there would be no Daptone as we know it.
I absolutely agree. So a major break for Daptone, and I would say probably their first biggest break, came in 2006 when their house band, the Dap Kings, collaborated with Mark Ronson for Amy Winehouse's album Back to Black. How did that collaboration come about, and what did the success of the album do for Daptone?
Musicians get around, right? So even though Neil Sugarman and Gabe Roth weren't going to Mark Ronson's DJ gigs or to his studio necessarily, some of their musicians definitely were. And the story goes that trumpet player Dave Guy, who is now a member of the Roots, brought a demo tape to Mark Ronson. And Ronson was already working with Amy Winehouse, trying to develop her second record, make it less jazzy, but he couldn't quite figure out how to do so. Said he used every studio trick in the book and it still wasn't vibing. So he plays her a Daptone or Dap Kings demo and she loves it. So he set up some studio time. And Amy wasn't there for the majority of the tracks that the Dap Kings recorded for Back to Black, but they are absolutely integral to her sound, to the sound of that album. So depending on who you talk to, Amy Winehouse had a enormous influence on the label, or it did nothing for them. It didn't gain them any new fans. Bosco would probably say that the average listener doesn't know and really doesn't care that the Dap Kings backed her on this very, very popular album, and one that I would say brought soul music or soul revival into the mainstream. But some of the musicians, really thought the gig was great. It was a wonderful chance for them to work with this producer. It was their first big money gig, and it also led to very, very fruitful collaborations with some of them. For example, Tom Brennick, guitarist who works with Charles Bradley, with the Budos Band, with many others, developed a close working relationship with Mark Ronson and now shares a studio with him. Homer Steinweiss, the drummer, is also on a lot of Mark Ronson productions. So I think the Amy Winehouse record did good for a variety of musicians, but more than anything, it was a situation where all boats rise with the tide.
I would have to say I agree with Bosco there that the success of Back to Black necessarily didn't reflect upon Daptone because it's such a singer-focused album, and given Amy's massive talent and her controversies at the time, I'm sure it was very hard for the casual listener to kind of pay attention to the other details of what's happening. I personally believe that 100 Days, 100 Nights that we had discussed earlier and that was released in 2007 was the first big like milestone album for that label and kind of set them on the success from there. What's your perception on that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think that people who do care to make these connections, journalists, radio people, might have been more inclined to play Dap King's record or Dap Tone record rather, after knowing that Amy Winehouse is somehow involved. But I think that 100 Days, 100 Nights, a great album, also the first album that I heard from the Dap Kings, I think that would have stood on its own regardless. They had been working so hard by that point, and it was their third album out. So after all of these releases, after all of these road miles, after all of these amazing shows, that record is so damn good that even if Amy Winehouse were out of the picture, I think they still would have been successful.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Who were some of the other artists on Dap Tone Records during that first decade?
Absolutely. So although Sharon is the shining light, there are lots of other projects. For example, there are the Mighty Imperials, and that includes the drummer Homer Steinweiss, who I mentioned earlier. This was a teenage hard funk group that was sort of in the periphery of the disco days, for sure. Actually, they were a disco band and only released their records once Dap Tone came into existence. You also had a group, Antibolus, a sort of Afrobeat flip to the funk that they were putting out on Dap Tone, often with a lot of the same players. There were the Sugarman 3, as I mentioned before, and a host of other folks. I feel like I'm forgetting somebody major. I guess within the first decade too, you had the Budos Band, who were some members of Mighty Imperials as well, and the sort of 0.5 generation of Dap Tone, guys who sort of came up listening to them, maybe sneaking into their shows in Manhattan when they were underage. You had Lee Fields, who was crucial to the germination of this whole thing. And then, obviously later, you get Charles Bradley, and his contribution cannot be understated either.
Absolutely not. And if you want an overview of the kinds of artists and sounds from that first decade of Dap Tone Records, I got two albums for you to check out. There's Dap Tone Gold, which was the first compilation that covers like the first 10 years. Absolutely amazing. And then there was this random sampler CD that was curated by Scion, the car from Toyota, that was all, it was just like remixes. It has like really great remixes of like classic Daptone songs, like How Long Do I Have to Wait for You has a fantastic remix that I love better than the studio version. So for listeners out there, Daptone Gold in the Scion CD sampler, if you can find that, are going to be your best entry points into the first decade of Daptone.
It's funny that you should mention this Scion sampler, actually, because the Scion sampler was great for Daptone, but also really good for other funk and soul artists across the country. And it sort of helped them meet the contemporary hip hop acts that were interested in the same roots that they were. So, for example, Orgone, a funk and boogie band in Southern California, they were put onto this compilation. I think we're talking about the same one, or perhaps it was a series. Yeah. And same thing happened with Connie Price and the Keystones, also a Southern California band. And there's a number of other people who were put on like a Scion tour as well, opening for these contemporary hip hop acts. Are you not seeing that on your compilation?
No, I am. I'm actually looking at it right now, and I see like Wale, Kenny Dope, a Large Professor, which I'm not familiar with, but it's such a fun CD.
Yeah, I agree, and it's so weird that like Scion would do this, but hey, this was back when people had CD players in their cars, so why not?
So moving on into the second decade of Daptone Records, we enter Charles Bradley, who we had mentioned a few times before, released his first studio album in 2011. And like Sharon Jones, he was another Daptone artist who worked his way up and would become one of the label's biggest stars, maybe even in some ways surpassing Sharon. And you talk about in your book some of the issues there and some jealousy matters. And Charles was known for his vulnerability and singing about pain from the death of his soul. What was his background and how did he become involved with Daptone?
So Charles had a particularly hardscrabble life. He also came up from the South, or from Florida, moved to Bed-Stuy, New York, and his brother was murdered when he was a teenager, which had a profound impact on him. He left home when he was a young teenager and was homeless for many years, traveled the country cooking for work, had bouts of homelessness. He was functionally illiterate most of his life, and just a very, very sweet and sensitive man who I think had been beaten down by life quite a bit, but seemed to maintain this internal flame. So he was living in San Francisco for many years, and made his way back to New York to reconcile with his mother, who was sick, moved back in with her, and was doing jobs as a handyman. And no one quite knows how he found out about Daptone Records, but one day he showed up at Bosco's apartment door saying, "I heard you needed a singer." Everyone thought that was really weird, but they took his information, and later went to see him perform as a James Brown impersonator at a local bar. Now, this was something that really kept that flame going, kept that flame burning, was performing as Black Velvet. And that persona was a security blanket for Charles. But when another singer fell through for a project, they decided to hit him up. And Charles Bradley first recorded with Daptone in, I believe, 2004 with members of the Budos Band. Nothing really came from that. They put out two singles, but it didn't really do much of the world of Daptone. And years later, they reconnected with him, and kind of the rest is history.
So after a decade of hard work, Daptone is finally being recognized as a pioneer of the soul revival. And this is when you start seeing their influences in other areas of popular culture. I remember in the theater in 2013 watching Martin Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street and Sharon Jones, and the Dap Kings are performing there. How was Daptone's influence being felt after this, being recognized as being a pioneer?
Well, prior to them being in Wolf of Wall Street, they also had a bunch of different placements. I remember their cover of This Land Is Your Land was in that movie with George Clooney, Up in the Air, and then a song from 100 Days, 100 Nights was in the movie Waitress as well on a jukebox. And Sharon was in the film The Great Debaters. So they are out there. And I think that their influence, I mean, certainly by me, certainly I'm guessing by you and other folks like us, I think their influence was immense. And it was really just exciting to be able to see this sort of music performed live and that new things are coming out. And anybody who's into funk and soul knows that the well is infinite. And you can go back as far as you want and never learn everything that there is to know about this in terms of artists and labels and whatnot. But to have something that's coming out in a contemporary sense was really exciting. And as a result, you saw the creation of other bands and other labels. And this is not just in New York, and it's not just in Los Angeles. It is across the country. It's international. And in, you know, the 2010s, there is absolutely a soul revolution brewing around the world. And it is a beautiful thing. And we are still seeing the fruits of that today.
So as Daptone was experiencing huge success throughout the 2010s, their lead players, Sharon and Charles, were getting older and sicker. Both would eventually pass away from cancer a few years ago. Share with us what their final years of performing were like.
They hit it hard. Sharon was prepping the release of Give the People What They Want in 2013 when she kind of found out that she had cancer, went into a fairly intense treatment, had surgery, and was recovering for months while everything was put on hold. And when she came back in 2014, it seemed as if she had this renewed vigor. I recall seeing her at the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco on that first tour back, and I wept. It was so incredible to just like see her come out, and it was as if she had like kicked cancer's ass and then kicked herself into a high gear. And she stayed at that level. I think that for Sharon, that brush with death really made her playing even more important. It made getting her message and her music out to the audience even more important. And the same for Daptone, who realized what the loss of this colleague and friend would mean for them personally and also for their business. So that became ever more important and scary when Sharon's cancer came back in 2016. And she pretty much, you know, played up until she was much too ill to do so and had a stroke the night of the 2016 election. Charles, as well, he had had a couple of bouts of illnesses. And mind you, all these people are in their 60s. So Sharon was 60 when she passed, and Charles was 67. And despite all the energy that they had on stage and how much they put into touring and recording, death comes for us all. So Charles had had a few illnesses and was pretty sick during his last tour, but was keeping up with things. he was undergoing treatment, and at some point on their European tour, got very sick and had to be taken from a hotel on a stretcher. He was convalescing. They canceled their touring schedule, and things seemed to be going better. And at a certain point, he leaves for a holistic retreat in Mexico that no one really knows about, and everybody at the label was asked to keep quiet about. And he came back from it. He had no medication. He went into hospice, and he passed away. Now, I'm sort of jumping ahead in timeline here because there, like Sharon, was a period where Charles came back from battling cancer and was doing well. He was performing, he was touring, and, you know, people were feeling good. These were not people who were ailing musicians. Like, you would not have known that until the very, very end. And to have Charles's band tell it, like, he was still strong until the very last performance that they ever did. So I think it was very hard for these young men who were touring with him, but perhaps less surprising for the heads of Daptone and others in the Dap Kings who had been through that before with Sharon.
So we had mentioned Daptone Records earlier and about their friendship, but also there's a business relationship here. So how did Daptone Records handle this going forward? What was their creative direction, and how were they able to find new audiences losing their two biggest acts so close together?
It was a challenge, and in my reporting for this book and for articles prior, I asked them if they had like a contingency plan for this, because hindsight, you think, well, these people are older, there's a chance, but they never really did. They just had to pivot, essentially. They took on more studio projects. Other people left for other opportunities. Daptone put out a posthumous album for Sharon. Of Sharon's, that was very well received, and it came out a year after her passing. There was a posthumous Charles record that was also pretty well received. But all of these things are very difficult for the folks at the label to put together. They're mourning their friends, but also have to keep up a business and, in a sense, keep up appearances. Right? The appearance that, like, this label isn't totally going to go under. At the same time, they also lost two other very important people, and somebody I forgot to mention earlier in that first, like, 10 years of Daptone, Naomi Shelton, of Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens. She was foundational for them as well. Their band leader, Cliff Driver, passed away in 2016 as well. Naomi would pass away, I believe it was last year or the year before. And also in 2016, Dan Klein, who is the singer of Daptone's first rocksteady band, Frighteners, died of ALS in his early 30s. And that record came out just months after he died. So Daptone, I think, fortunately, because they were so prolific, had a lot of stuff in the can that they could put out after all of these passings, but it was not an easy going for them.
So I want to talk about one quote in your book, and I thought it was an incredible thing that you wrote in here. I absolutely loved it. In your book, you say, regardless of the message, soul music is fundamentally political, and the mere presence of Daptone singers, most of whom were middle-aged, black, and performing for audiences who might not share their experience, was in itself a progressive statement. And I know we talked about earlier Gabe and some of the other band members and foundational people in Daptone's history are white. There was the skepticism of Sharon about being around these white people. And even when we talk about how soul music was permeating in these subcultures, there's going to be a lot of gatekeeping and a lot of white gatekeeping from people who can actually afford the time and money to find these records. So share with us more about how Daptone contributed and addressed representation and perhaps some of the criticisms as well.
Sure. Well, I'm really glad that you like that sentence. Thank you. And I think this is a really important topic because the people, the two heads of this label are white Jewish men. Their singers are Black, almost across the board. So I don't know how cognizant they were of race in those early days. And I know that Sharon certainly didn't like to talk about it that much. I think that generally they had this idea that people were people and that there was a general level of respect for each other and each other's backgrounds within the band, so that it wasn't so much of an issue. However, the audience for these records or at these shows is not necessarily, it's pretty white. It could be very homogenous, especially at the beginning of their run. Even though Daptone's audience, at least by glance at an average show, is probably whiter than one would like to see. Obviously, diversity is a really important thing. I think that they did the best that they could do by trying to honor their performers, honor the history of soul music, and talk about it widely. They probably could have done more, especially when we're looking at this from the lens of 2022 and after Black Lives Matter. I would be very curious how Sharon would have responded to this movement and how Charles would as well. But I think that by being advocates for this music, they were taking a step towards inclusivity. I think it's really important, and I think that these are issues that we really need to examine, and things that I enjoy thinking about, even if they're difficult. And frankly, I don't know if it's my place as a white woman to be like, this is what Daptone should have done, you know? Nor do I need to put that burden on a Black reader or a Black listener, or just any listener of color to be like, this is what Daptone should have done. I think that it is the responsibility of a good artist to reflect the times that they're in. And even if a lot of Daptone's songs were sort of apolitical on the surface, they do have a deeper political resonance in some of their lyrics, and just the fact that, like, I was idolizing for sure, a Black woman in her 60s who is just laying the stage to waste. That said, I mean, within the soul scene, Daptone is very closed. And, you know, that could lead to a certain amount of gatekeeping by white men. I don't really know a lot of Black, like, heads of labels within this scene. So if we're talking about gatekeeping, that's something to consider. And one last thing about this. The next generation of soul singers is, and soul groups, I think, is widely more diverse as well. Which is not to make light of the fact that the Dap Kings had Latino members, they had white members, they had Jewish members, they had Black members, they had members who were Indigenous. Like, you know, it's complicated.
One criticism of Daptone Records is that while it was inventive, their efforts didn't embody the revolutionary spirit of the 1960s and rather aped convention. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that no music exists in a vacuum. And it is impossible to make this music and not be referential to something, even if it is conventional. I think certain things are could be like a little schlocky, but overall, I disagree with that sentiment entirely. I could name some groups that I think are aping convention and are very hokey, that are like in this next generation or 0.5 generation of soul artists, but to be diplomatic, I will not. They are not Daptone bands, though.
Well, let's talk about the next generation of Daptone bands. So the Daptone Records 20th anniversary came along during the COVID-19 pandemic. Where is Daptone now as it enters into its third decade, and what is next for them?
So Daptone, I found out recently, is closing up its Bushwick shop because, because Gabe Roth lives in California and has a wonderful studio out there where he's recording a lot of bands, mostly sweet soul groups, on his Penrose imprint. Neil Sugarman lives in Switzerland. And I think that in New York, there is not as much going on for the label. However, in the next generation of Daptone, they're continuing to put out music from some of their existing artists. I don't know how much of this is public yet. And their next big release is from a group that's based in San Diego called The Sacred Souls. They're a trio that are putting out this sort of mid-60s, mid to like slow tempo soul music, love songs. And that album will come out in on August 28th. And I plan to write about it for Writing Sources, so stay tuned.
I look forward to reading it.
Thanks, yeah. And those people are, the Sacred Souls are part of a larger scene dedicated to sweet soul music as well, which I necessarily wouldn't have thought was the next foray in soul music, but here we are, and it's like a really lovely thing.
You know, soul music continues to live, and it's going to go through more revivals, and that's incredibly exciting.
I agree. And I mean, I think it's here to stay. And if the past 60 years have taught us anything, that's not exactly a far out prediction.
Well, Jessica, this has been a great conversation, and I had a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me today.
Likewise, Bradley. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. And may I just add a personal here, how much I loved this book, just being a fan of Daptone Records, and to convey my appreciation for you for overcoming the challenge of being the first to comprehensively document this indie label. I'm sure it wasn't easy, and it came out just spectacularly.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot to me, truly.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books in Music with my guest today, Jessica Lipsky. Her book is It Ain't Retro, Daptone Records and the 21st Century Soul Revolution, and is published by Jawbone Press.